It's Friday. You know what that means, right? The last 5 days in this economy in 5 minutes, first of all, but also it means it's Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosenthal. It is Friday, the 19th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It was said once upon a time in this economy that summer was a slow news season. I don't know where the people who used to say that are, but those days are long, long gone. We got monetary policy. We got consumers and businesses. Never a dull moment. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Dion Rabowan is at Axios. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
What's going on, Kai?
So, Lynette, let me go with you first and give me, if you would, a macroeconomic table set. How we doing, do you think?
The thing is, we're doing well, at least here in the United States. Emerging markets are looking a little shaky. China, again, is starting to show weakness. But here in the United States, things are looking good. At the same time, the president is taking, you know, credit for this booming economy. He's also begging the Fed to lower interest rates because,
Because.
I don't know.
Well, hang on. We'll get to the Fed in a minute. Dion, I want to riff a little bit on what Lynette said. So corporate earnings season is this week. Generally, things are going really well. Consumers are feeling good. They're buying more at retail. What's not to like from where you see it?
Why is there got to be something not to like from Rice?
I don't know. I'm just asking.
You know, me, I'm a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed...
As journalists, we generally do.
That's right. No, so one of the things that I wrote about this week in the Axios Markets newsletter that I know you subscribe to was the actual slowdown in retail sales growth, particularly online. And it's happening. You can see it when you walk down the street. You see stores closing. Retail sales are just slowing, but it's also slowing online, which is the big thing moving forward retail sales overall.
Okay, so let's take that then and turn, if we might, Lynette, to the Federal Reserve, not the president. I don't want to talk about the president. I want to talk about the Fed, because expectations are that the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates. I want to know why, because the economy, by all measures, is strong. And I should say, by the way, we've got an interview with the president of the Boston Fed, Eric Rosengren, coming up in the second half of the program. And I talked to him about this. But why is everybody counting on the Fed to cut rates? Dion, you'll get yours in a minute. Lynette, you go first.
Well, unclear. The Fed's mandate is to, you know, maintain employment and to ensure, you know, that inflation stays steady. And it seems like they've done both those things. We don't really see inflation anywhere in the economy and or in the world, really. And the employment numbers are looking good. So it's unclear why the Fed would want to cut interest rates, except for the pressure that it's getting from the White House. And also, it seems like markets are consistently reacting, too. But again, that's outside the Fed's mandate. The Fed isn't supposed to care what the stock market does. It's not supposed to care about what stock markets overseas are doing or what China's central bank is worried about or anything. It's just supposed to care about inflation and employment.
Dion Rabowan, over to you.
Yeah. That's mostly true, but the Fed has been setting this interest rate cut up since April.
Stop. Why are they setting it up?
Have they?
Well, they kind of have, right? Powell has made it pretty clear that he's going to at least a pause and then a cut. But why, Dion, have they felt it necessary?
Well, they felt it necessary, one, because of the president's trade war and the economic uncertainty that they're feeling. You saw it in this week's Beige Book report that came out, about 37 different comments, or the word tariffs was mentioned 37 different times. And you saw a number of comments from business owners who were saying, we're not sure what's going on, so we're pulling back, we're holding back on investment, we're holding back on buys, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one thing they've been worried about. But you also are looking at a Fed that has a lot less economists and a lot more markets guys than it had in the past. Jay Powell in particular, the chair, is a guy who hears a lot more from markets, from investors, from people on that side of things than Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke ever heard. So he's much more amenable to the concerns of the market. And you're seeing that anytime the market starts to price something in, Jay Powell is pretty certain to go along.
Interesting. Go ahead, Lynette.
But we're not talking enough about what the consequences of lowering rates are when we really don't need to. I'm not worried about runaway inflation. That's
right,
not going to happen. It's not anywhere in the world. But what if something does happen, the economy does slow down, and then we have a limited toolbox because we've already cut rates at a time when we didn't really need to, and we don't have that, like, you know, power up?
Yeah.
Also, no, asset bubbles.
That's a good point. All right. A very quick turn to trade, actually, since Dion mentioned it. Lynette, talk to me about your feelings about China and whether there's going to be a deal. Secretary Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, said today, you know, we had a conversation with the Chinese. We might do in-person talks. Discuss.
The Chinese have introduced a new hardline negotiator, and the Chinese press hasn't changed its tune at all, which obviously the Chinese press is dictated by the government itself. So when the press hasn't changed its tune, it's still bellicose. It's still blaming all of this on the United States. It doesn't look like anything has changed, and we might be in for another, you know, kind of roller coaster ride of, oh, maybe there'll be a deal to, uh-oh, things are looking ugly again. The market starts puking and everybody's hair is on fire.
It's the circle that never ends.
Right.
Yeah,
it sort of is. Dion, I want to real quick actually circle back to the top, and you got like 30 seconds to do this. You and Lynette both said the domestic economy is strong. Things are fine. Little weakness overseas. How long do you suppose it might take for contagion overseas to come here, if ever?
That's a very good question, and it really depends a lot on this China trade deal. That's what's been weakening things overseas, and it's not just the U.S. and China, right? China is the number one trading partner with most of the world. It's the world's largest trading nation. They do a lot more trade, buying and selling with the rest of the world. So Europe is very dependent on China. Japan's very dependent on China. And if China starts to slow down, that's those three. They're three of the world's four largest growth engines that could start to slow. We've been seeing this already in Europe and Japan, particularly Germany, which is a very big manufacturing economy. So if that continues, you could start to see it. And we're already starting to see it in the manufacturing data.
Right.
If you start to see it in the services sector, then we're in trouble.
All right. Dion Rabowan at Axios, the markets newsletter. Subscribe. I'll get you the plug there so you don't have to do it. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you too. Stay cool in New York.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a nice
weekend. Do my best.
We'll try.
Quick check on oil here before we go on. Given that Iran has seized a couple of tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, crude up just a touch for that day on the news. Down a bunch for the week, though. The U.S. benchmark off 7% Monday through Friday, $55 and change a barrel. Stocks today, thanks for asking. Up to start, down to finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The most valuable startup in this economy, that is venture capital-backed, not publicly traded company, is generally agreed to be the shared workspace company WeWork, something like $47 billion in valuation. And that's why a report in the Wall Street Journal caught our eye. The paper says WeWork's co-founder Adam Neumann has been using his stake in the company to raise cash, $700 million in cash. He's been doing it by taking out loans against his equity and selling some of his own stock, which is interesting because WeWork's gearing up to go public this year, perhaps, and a founder trimming down his stake ahead of an IPO is not necessarily a great look. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the economics of going public are changing.
Investors in private companies want to see the company founders hold on to their stock ahead of an IPO, says Kathleen Smith at Renaissance Capital.
We like to see founders have skin in the game.
Smith's Renaissance Capital invests in newly public companies, and she says if a founder holds on to their stock ahead of an IPO, it inspires confidence. If a founder sells, investors might worry about what could happen after the company goes public.
Because they'll see a founder who has very little downside if things go wrong.
But WeWork's IPO is happening when the economy is strong. The stock market's been on the rise, too. So for WeWork's co-founder, Adam Neumann,
if he has to take out money, I guess this was the right time to do it.
That's Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners. He points out that WeWork leases space to other companies and the real estate market.
It's been doing very well. Interest rates are low. The vacancy rates are low.
The practice of selling stock in a private company before it goes public is becoming more common. The founders of Snap, Zynga, and Groupon did it ahead of their IPOs. Companies are waiting longer before going public, which makes the incentive for founders to cash out even stronger. Plus, Jay Ritter at the University of Florida says there's a growing interest from investors who want to get in early.
There's so much money from venture capital funds, sovereign wealth funds, to invest in these private companies.
But that private company stock, it's only available if someone's willing to sell it. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
More than 2 million people watched the Phillies beat the Dodgers 7-6 yesterday. 2 million people for a game available only on YouTube. Hometown fans in Philadelphia and L.A. couldn't even watch it on their regional sports networks. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what Major League Baseball and YouTube hope to get out of this distribution deal.
YouTube is going to live stream a total of 13 games through the end of this year's baseball season, with its own play-by-play and color commentary and pre- and post-game shows. But that's only one in 100 games. What's the play here?
This is a test to see what works.
Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College in Massachusetts. He says the old model for baseball was that teams sold exclusive rights to broadcast most of their games to regional TV distributors, your Comcast or Time Warner, and the really big games to Fox or ESPN.
Model worked really well. Television revenues grew year after year after year.
But that old model hit a limit. Baseball viewership is declining, so MLB is looking at other models.
And the best way to learn how to massage something is to first test it out and see what it looks like.
Baseball tested it with Facebook last year. The social media platform carried 25 Major League Baseball games exclusively.
I think it probably didn't pay off the way Facebook expected.
That's Todd Spangler, an editor at Variety. Zuckerberg and company scaled back this year with non-exclusive rights to 6 games. But live sports are still valuable to advertisers because viewers sit through commercials. Spangler says companies showing games can still charge a pretty penny for ad time.
It is premium content. YouTube will be able to get a higher advertising rate for this kind of content.
From Major League Baseball's perspective, the overarching goal is pretty simple. Get younger fans and meet them on the platforms that they use. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Don't know if you saw this a couple of months ago, but the World Health Organization has officially classified burnout as an occupational phenomenon. That is, being exhausted or depleted by one's work. And a new report commissioned by the mental health provider Yellowbrick shows 96% of millennials are affected by burnout in their daily lives. So, you're a millennial, burned out at work, burned out by daily life. What's your go-to coping mechanism? From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Like a lot of millennials, 29-year-old James Maloney finds it hard to put his phone down, even when he's off the clock.
So you can feel like you're on edge and still, you know, kind of on call.
To take that edge off, he's increasingly turning to a night on the couch with some streaming TV.
We throw on the Great British Baking Show.
Another great day of baking ahead.
The only tension is my scone going to be burned or not?
Streaming TV was the most cited coping mechanism for millennials experiencing burnout, higher than exercise, sleep, drinking, or talking with friends.
So it takes you to a different place, right? It takes you mentally into another world.
Robin Nabi is a communications professor at UC Santa Barbara who says television has always been used to de-stress, but streaming TV, with its instant access to entire seasons, takes that escapism to another level. And that's not always good.
If what you're watching is highly stimulating, then that arousal might actually lead you to feel a little bit more stressed.
That happens to 33-year-old PhD candidate Jeremiah Bailey, who keeps up a streaming diet of dystopian sci-fi like Black Mirror.
It is very stressful. I have to watch something else afterwards sometimes.
But that impulse to keep watching can also become destructive, says psychotherapist Richard Schuller.
Anything that gives you a physiological response of pleasure has the potential to be addictive.
Especially if it's designed for maximum bingeability, as streaming shows are. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The outcomes from June till now have been quite good. I think we should continue to focus on that. But there are certainly uncertainties that we have to think about.
So interest rate cut? No interest rate cut? The word, kinda, from the president of the Boston Fed. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 0.2% today, 68 points, 27,154. The NASDAQ threw off 0.7%, 60 points, 60 points. Ended things at 81.46. The S&P 500 dropped 0.6%, 18 points there, 29.76. For the week, the Dow gave back 0.6%. The NASDAQ forfeited 1.1%. The S&P 500 down 1.2%. That report that Iran has captured a couple of tankers in the Strait of Hormuz gave some energy to energy stocks. Occidental Petroleum surged more than 2.5%. Marathon Oil poured on an extra 2%. GM unveiled its latest redesign of the Corvette. The 2020 Stingray is going to go from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. Perhaps because for the first time, GM put the engine in the middle. Don't know. Shares didn't accelerate quite so quickly, though, but they were up 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I mentioned it with Lynette and Dion a little bit up at the beginning of the program, a speech the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston made today about Fed independence and how the central bank is looking at the economy right now. We went over, Eric Rosengren and I did, the nuts and bolts of the speech itself. His basic gist is that it's okay for Congress to tell the Fed what it should focus on. Stable prices and maximum employment, the dual mandate, which we talk about all the time, but that the Fed should be able to decide how it gets the economy there in the end. And then we went bigger picture. You are, I think, the last Fed governor who will speak before the Fed enters its quiet period before its next meeting. You all spend a lot of time on communication. The chairman does. You can't turn around without a Fed governor making a speech, as you are today. What are you trying to tell people?
Well, it's important for people to understand how the economy is evolving and why we take the actions that we do. So it does get back to that accountability and the governance of the Fed. That 30 years ago, chairs of the Fed prided themselves in being obscure. That's no longer true. Being credible and transparent and thinking about communication are a much more important part of central banking than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And that means we really want the public to understand that we are trying to get maximum employment and get stable prices over time.
You know, it sure does look like, and I say this with all respect, it does look like y'all are paying a lot of attention to the markets lately, that you are attuned to how they are reacting. And I will point you just to yesterday and your colleague John Williams at the New York Fed, who gave a speech that said, you know, basically you got to cut when you got to cut. And so look out below. And then the market reacted. And an hour and a half, 2 hours later, the New York Fed had to walk it back and say, no, this was just an academic discussion. Talk to me about how you react to the markets, would you?
So we certainly pay attention to what's happening in financial markets. Financial markets are signaling what's happening in the overall economy. And people are investing dollars with a perspective on how the economy is going to evolve. So there is information from financial markets that we shouldn't ignore. But in the longer run, our goal is not to do something that, for example, on a temporary basis causes the stock market to go up but then decline sometime in the future, which is why our mandated goals from Congress are really focused on inflation and unemployment and not those financial variables.
I truly don't want to get too far into what the president has to say about the Federal Reserve, and I know you don't either, but Chairman Powell has said to me, and he has said to Congress and everybody who will listen, that he's sticking around and the Fed is politically independent, and it should be. That said, it cannot be ignored that at your next meeting, there is an expectation you're going to cut rates, which is what the president wants you to do.
So it's very important that we're data dependent. The outcomes from June till now have been quite good. I think we should continue to focus on that. But there are certainly uncertainties that we have to think about. One of those uncertainties would be whether we get a disruptive trade situation with China or with other trading partners. So I think those are considerations that we have to think about as well.
But in the end, we should be focused on the data and not be particularly swayed by anything else that's going on.
So is this the pause that virtually, or in fact, the rate cut that everybody's expecting, but I'll call it a pause because one never wants to predict the future. Is this pause sort of a just-in-case pause?
So my own view is that the economy is actually doing quite well. And at least to date, there's not that much evidence in the data that the economy is slowing down. We're probably going to get a GDP growth for the second quarter around 2%. That's certainly slower than how fast we were growing last year, which was closer to 3%. But nonetheless, it's faster than what the economy is going to grow in the longer run, which I would estimate to be about 1.75%. So it's actually a pretty good outcome. And my expectation is that the economy over the course of this year will continue to be growing at roughly 2%.
I was going to let you go, but then you said 1.75% in the long term. That's not good or high. Take your pick on the word you want to use.
Well, it depends on your framework. So it used to be the population was growing much more quickly. The labor force was growing much more quickly. And productivity was much higher. So it isn't good news to the extent that productivity hasn't been as strong as we would like. But the demographic trends are something that's affecting not only us, but Europe and Japan as well. And there's not much the Fed can do about demographics. So when you think about how fast the economy can grow, if you have a slowly growing population and the demographics are older, you're not going to have the same kind of growth as if your population's expanding very rapidly.
Eric Rosengren, he's the president of the Boston Fed. Mr. Rosengren, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
I've enjoyed talking with you.
Shouldn't you be curious or confused, actually, about how the regional Federal Reserve banks work? We are here for you. The story is online at marketplace.org. Take a minute tomorrow, 10:56 p.m. on the East Coast. Adjust, of course, for your local time zone and look up at the moon. It'll be a waning gibbous, just as it was 50 years ago when humanity first set foot there. The moon landing was, of course, born out of the Cold War and the arms race, but its legacy can be seen in technologies found all over this economy and in the private sector as well, half a century later. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
As it traveled 238,900 miles through the vacuum of space 50 years ago, the Apollo 11 spacecraft had to chart a carefully calculated orbit.
Altitude 5,200
feet. Flight controllers, gonna go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
It had to go from a top speed of around 25,000 miles per hour to just 2,000 orbiting the moon. And then it had to split in two, send down a landing module called the Eagle that would make the most ever so gentle stop on the moon's surface.
The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
The only way to do these kinds of real-time navigational calculations was with a computer.
When Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, there was no computer anywhere in the world small enough and powerful enough to fly a spaceship to the moon.
Charles Fishman is author of One Giant Leap, the impossible mission that flew us to the moon.
The smallest computers at that time were the size of three or four refrigerators lined up together.
So NASA hired MIT to build the smallest, fastest computer ever created. It was about the size of a briefcase. And Fishman says this made NASA the first major customer for a brand new invention, the computer chip.
This Apollo flight computer turned out to be the number one customer in the world for computer chips 4 years running.
Those computer chips were designed in what, by the end of the 60s, would be called Silicon Valley. Paul Cerruzzi is a curator emeritus at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
The contract to develop those chips was important to get what later became Silicon Valley a jump start.
Not just in terms of business, but in terms of being taken seriously. David Mindell is a professor at MIT.
Using chips in such a high-profile, life-critical situation for such a brand-new technology was just an enormous boost to the credibility of this technology.
The navigation system using these chips was the only thing keeping three men from being flung into the endless void of space. The chips were rigorously tested for coping with G-forces, vacuums, radiation. If one chip out of a 1,000-chip batch didn't pass any test, all 1,000 of them were thrown out. Again, Paul Cerruzzi.
Those tests, which were necessary for a spacecraft, also turned out to be very useful for what eventually became consumer products.
The progress in chip size and power was so rapid that by the time the Eagle landed on the moon in 1969, the chips used to get it there were already outdated on Earth.
Apollo dramatically accelerated the computer revolution.
Again, Charles Fishman, author of One Giant Leap.
Dramatically accelerated both the quality of the chips and their acceptability.
He says it won an argument. If any business was thinking, can we really rely on these new computer things? Well, the answer was, those computer things sent two men to the moon and back. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which I do believe is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. We did an interview a couple of months ago, maybe, about smart diapers. Bluetooth-enabled sensors go on them, which will then tell an app on your phone, well, you get my drift, right? Anyway, turns out, says CNN, that Pampers is reporting its smart diaper model already has a waiting list, man. All right, we are out of here. The Dow down 0.2% today, 68 points. The NASDAQ off 0.7%, 60 points. S&P 500 dropped 0.6%, 18 points on that particular index. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.